Hello, my name is Sherry Saunders. I am 65 years old. Today is, October 21st, 2019, and I'm speaking with my husband, David Aiken. We're recording this interview in Orlando, Florida.
I am David Aiken. I'm the wife of Sherry, my beautiful wife.
You're my wife?
I'm sorry, my wife is, I'm the husband of my beautiful wife, Sherry, I'm 79 years old, 2 months I'll be 80.
Excellent. Okay. David, I know you spent many years as a radio disc jockey. How did you get into that?
Well, it was an accident. I was 37 years old. I had two failed marriages behind me. I had moved 1,000 miles away from Chicago, where I had been for years and years, and where my daughter was still living. And I was living in Miami, Florida. I was driving a beer truck. I had no real plans for a career or any kind of a life at all. I was just taking it day by day and to see what happens. And I was sharing an apartment with a young man, and he wanted to be a sports announcer, a sports reporter. Now, in Miami, there was, as part of the Miami-Dade school system, an adult section where you could do trades and that sort of thing for a very cheap price. It was only about $15 or $20 to go to the school, which was hard to beat. So I had a day off from work, and he asked me to go up to the school and get some information for him about how to apply to the school and to get in and all that sort of thing. So I went up there. It was about 20 miles away, and I got lost. And I had to call the school to ask them how to get there. And the man who answered was the instructor who had been a career radio guy in Miami for a long time before he retired to do this, to be a teacher. I said, I'm interested in coming to your school. But I'm lost, and how do I get there? And he said, I love your voice. Can you get here really quickly? So I got there, and I had a little interview with him, and he said I would be a good candidate for the school. So I had no other options in life, so I said, sure, why not? I'll do it. I got the information on how to apply, and I gave it to my friend, and he went and auditioned. And he didn't get it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So there was a little bit of hard feelings about that. But I went to the school for about 3 months. And it was the kind of school that didn't have it had graduation requirements. And the graduation requirement was that you got a job in radio. So you went to the school until you had achieved a level of competence in radio that could get you a job. And that's what happened. I did the radio thing, and it was something that I really liked and something that I found that I could do easily and well, which was a first for me. I had never had a job like that before. So I got started on my career. One of the at the school, they would have guest instructors to come in and explain different parts of working at a radio station, different duties and things, that sort of thing. And the we had an engineer. In those days, if you worked at a radio station, you had to have a third-class radio operator's license to run the transmitter. It was a requirement from the FCC that all radio stations had to take readings of their transmitter's performance, the power and the direction it was going and all that sort of thing. And if it got out of parameters, you had to fix it or you would be in trouble with the FCC. So he came in and told us how to get the engineer's license. He had to take a test, and he taught us what we needed to know, and I took the test, and I passed it, so I had that. He quit his job in Miami. He worked for one of the big stations down there as an engineer, and he got a job as a station manager in Sebring, Florida, a very small town, only 12,000 people in the town, and it was in Highlands County, and there were only about 100,000 people in the whole county. So it was a good place to start. That's where you start. You start at the bottom and work your way up. So he called the school, talked to the instructor, said he needed somebody, and the instructor talked to me and said, "Are you interested in this?" I gave the guy a call, and he said, "Come on up." So, Sebring is about 4 hours away from Miami, so I was going to have to move up there. I couldn't live in Miami and do the job. That's a pretty big move in life to pick up and go, but I went up there to see how it was going to work out. If it didn't, I was going to come back and try my luck in Miami. But I got up there, and he talked to me for a little bit, and he said, "Well, you're hired. You can start tomorrow." So I did, and I got a job. I got a room in a hotel in downtown Sebring. It was above a restaurant called the Cat House. Which I thought, when I first saw that, I thought, "Well, whoa, this is a pretty exciting town." But it was a little hotel up there. I got a room up there, and very, very sparse furnishings. It was a pretty cheap place to live, and I didn't have any money, so it was good. So I started the next day. And went from there. I got teamed me up with the morning disc jockey, and that's what I was going to be. I was going to be a disc jockey and a news reporter. I went in the morning and sat with the morning man, and learned how their equipment worked and where everything was and all that sort of thing. And so I came into work the next day, and he didn't. So he had quit. So that meant I was the morning man. There was nobody else there. So I got on the air, and I did my thing, and it went well. And I went from there, and I lasted at that station for about 7 years. 7 years, and I had been getting raises all that time, for good performance and all that sort of thing. And my boss came to me one day and said, "Well, you know, I can't really afford you anymore. You're making too much money." This is the guy who gave me the raises. So that was it. I was out of that job. I went home, and I went to bed. And I laid there feeling sorry for myself and saying, "Oh, woe is me. What am I going to do now?" And then I said, "This is a waste of time." So I got out of bed, and I had been talking to a man in Avon Park who was running a video rental store. But on the side, he was doing commercials for cable TV. It was very, very new at that time. It was very, very primitive. But there was a cable operation in Sebring. and he was producing commercials for it. And he said if I ever wanted a job to come and see him. So I went up and saw him and said, I want a job. And he gave me one. So I was a TV commercial producer, writing the commercials and filming them and editing them and getting them on the air. So we did that for a while, and that lasted about 3 or 4 months, really. And then a fellow whose acquaintance I had made when he worked at a radio station in Avon Park, he had moved to a radio station in Winter Haven, WGTO, which GTO stands from Gulf to Ocean. That's what their signal was. It was a directional signal, so it went from the Gulf to the ocean, but north and south didn't go very far. But that's what the call letters meant anyway. So he said, well, we've got an opening here for a newsman in the afternoon. Come on up and see if they'll hire you. So I went up there and I did a little audition, and the manager said, okay, you can start tomorrow. I'd been doing the news at the other radio station. In addition to my other duties, I was the morning disc jockey, the program director, the production director, making commercials, and I was the news guy too. So, and I made coffee in the morning too. Though those were my duties. So I had some experience with doing the news. So they hired me, and I was hired to do the afternoon news. And the fella who got me the job, he was the morning guy. He was on the morning team. You know, every radio station back then, but even today, some of them do have a team of people who get along well and are enjoyable to listen to and that sort of thing. And he was one of the team anyway. So, but they didn't. He was having to do the afternoon too, and he was tired of that. It was a long day. So I became the news guy, and I did that for a while. And they also gave me disc jockey shifts on the weekend. So I was keeping my hand in doing that, and when somebody was sick, I would fill in for them and that sort of thing. We were doing a country music format, which I didn't know anything about country music, so I had to learn all that sort of thing, but it was set up pretty well. It was a good station. It was well run. But there was another country station in town, too. We were an AM station. And the other station was FM, which was a cleaner sound, and you could hear it pretty far away. So it was more popular. As it turned out, the man that they had hired to manage the station had been hired, we learned a while after I had been there, he'd been hired to run the station until it could be sold. So all the time I was there, I was in the process of trying to find a buyer for it. They finally did. It was a religious broadcaster. So the call letters went from Gulf to Ocean to God Took Over. But it was fun being there. Everybody was talented. A lot of people liked it because we played. We played a lot of the oldies in country, and that's really what the kind of music that I like these days, the original sounds, starting with Hank Jr. And Eddie Arnold and Loretta Lynn and those kind of people, and on up. And we had all those. We played those on our regular radio stations back then, and probably still today, have a schedule of what songs to play in a row. So I think we had a set of five different categories. Songs that were in the top 40 of the country music magazines, and then there was slow songs and fast songs and females and males and oldies. So we had a regular rotation for that. And people, this was in Polk County, Florida, which was a pretty rural area, and still is, I guess. So there were a lot of country people there, people who loved country music. And so we had a good listenership. But we did that for a while, and then they sold the station, and everybody was kicked out. The guy that had gotten me the job there had gone back to Highlands County. He had a job lined up there at a radio station, which the call letters were WWOJ, which didn't stand for anything. He said, why don't you come down here and see if he can get on there? So I went down there, and they hired me as a replacement disc jockey at first. And they had me do some news there, too. Radio used to be a pretty good source of news in those days, and not so much anymore. You can listen to a radio station all day long and not hear a breath of news. They had news, you know, with the Associated Press teletype machine and everything in there. That was their source of news. They didn't have any computers, of course. Then you couldn't go online and get the news. So I did that, and after a while, they gave me the afternoon shift, and I did that regularly, and it was. It was an AM-FM combination, the same owner. So on the FM, it was country music. On the AM, it was talk shows. It was conservative talk. Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and those people were pretty hot back then, and I guess they still are. So they did that all day, but they had a couple of hours that they left open for a local talk show host. And the guy that was the news director for the station was the host on the talk show. And he was conservative. So that was it, 24 hours of conservative talk. One day, they called me up at home and said, we've had to take, his name was Barry, we've had to take Barry off the air. We've had a disagreement over the work conditions and that sort of thing. So we have an opening on the talk show. Would you like to come in and do that? Well, I'll do anything twice. So, but actually, this was the first time that I would have done a talk show. I said, "Sure, I'll come in. How hard can it be? You just sit down and you talk." Well, little did I know. So, I went in and I did the show, and it went pretty well. It was a call-in show, so. People would call in, but I'm more on the liberal side than the conservative side. So that was a big change of pace. for the listeners, and they let the station know about that too. Said, what is this guy doing on there? And but they the owners and the managers were pretty supportive, and they let me talk about anything that I wanted to. I did that for well, he was suspended for 2 weeks, and so I did it for 2 weeks, and they apparently liked what I was doing with it because they gave me my own show, but it was only an hour long, but you know, an hour of liberalism offsets the 23 hours of conservatism. So I did that, and we would have guests on and do phone call-ins and that sort of thing, politicians and country music stars. There was a little bit of overlap in the in the stations. I did that show for quite a while. And then the day came, excuse me, it was an interesting show. And I was, I'll have to admit that I knew how to press the listeners' buttons pretty well, so that I would get a lot of phone calls in, you know, and they would yell at me, and we would try to discuss what was going on. In 1986, roughly. So Daddy Bush was the president then, and his son was the governor of Florida. Jeb was the governor of Florida. So we talked about the Bushes a lot. I called them the Shrubs. It was interesting. I had my devoted listeners there. There were some people who liked the more liberal side of things. So I had my supporters, and we got a lot of. It was a small town, so it became well known what I was doing on the radio, and the local newspaper would talk about what I was doing on the radio. So got some publicity that way. The editor of the newspaper was a member of the community theater that I belonged to. When I first got to Sebring, the new owner, or the new manager, the former engineer, he had been a number one disc jockey at New Orleans for a number of years before he became an engineer and went off on that sort of career. So, but his part of his goal was to get the station to be more popular. They didn't have ratings really in those days, but just talking to people, you could realize that not a lot of people were listening to the format that they were doing when I first started there. The format was the ownership before this liked album music, playing easy listening music. So there were hundreds of those kind of albums in the radio station. Well, we were going to be a top 40 station, so those albums were useless, really. But we had a problem with obtaining music to play on the radio. We played actual records back then. They had cartridges were just coming into use. So we were switching over to that, but we still had to play a lot of records. And if you ever watched WKRP in Cincinnati, you could it was kind of like the way the disc jockeys worked there. We had two turntables and a microphone. So we would play one record and then set up the next record on the other turntable. Now, we had the guy that had been the program director, who was responsible for what music was being played, was kind of a country boy. So his music kind of leaned that way, but when I got there, they had a collection of records to play, and it was in a box that sat right there in the studio by the microphone. There were 20 records in the box. Those were the ones that we played. So we had to play some of those albums. So we would play, when I became the program director, we were playing artists that nobody else was yet playing, like Dire Straits and Molly Hatchet and that sort of thing. So, but the because we were limited on the type of records that we had, we would play Molly Hatchet and then we'd play Steven Eady. So it was interesting, but it was catching on, you know, as we... There was a record store in town that we had a trade-out arrangement with. The owner couldn't afford to advertise, so she traded records for advertising. So we would do some commercials for her, and she would give us records to play on the radio. That was a pretty limited source. The policy with record companies in those days was when a new record came out, they would send a copy of it to every radio station in the country that played the kind of music that was on the record. But Sebring was just a little too small to be doing that, so we didn't get any of those kind of records. But we could and the owner of the record store was not, most of the stuff wasn't her type of music, so she didn't have it in stock. We would have to special order all the new stuff that came out. But it worked out after a while, and we did that for a number of years. Well, actually only about a year. The owner of the station... he had been a sales manager of a radio station in Miami, the number one station in Miami. The owners before him were lawyers in Miami. So we never saw them. They would come up once a month to do the books and pay the bills, but, you know, that was it. They didn't have any say in running the radio station, really. So the new guy was a hands-on guy. He had an office in the station, and he was interested in improving the audience for the radio station. So on I happened to be on a trip over to the west coast of Florida in the Fort Myers area, and I was listening to a radio station over there. It was playing a lot of old music, big band music, and songs from the, songs from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. It was called The Music of Your Life. I listened to this stuff, and I thought, wow, you know, this is Sebring was a retirement community. A lot of people retired there. So we had an audience ready-made that was in that age group that would appreciate this sort of thing. So I talked to the owner, and he was it was a syndicated format. You would get you signed up for this program, and they would send you all of your music on reel-to-reel tapes. So really big ones, really big tapes, a foot and a half wide. Wow. And there was a rotation, so you had to have three or four tape players so that you could be playing one category of song on one, and then it would be followed up by another category on the other player, and then the rotation of the songs was fixed. They would send you a list of what music to play, and what reel it was on, and what was and all that. Anyway, so we got that, we bought it. And we put it in, and it was a big hit right away. People were really talking about it. We had that going, and we had a pretty good staff. We had some pretty talented people. They were working there. I was the morning guy then, still, and we had. When I got there, there was a young lady who was had just graduated from the University of Florida, where she had been in their radio TV program, and she got hired down there to have her first job. She was doing the 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock shift. And then our engineer, every station had to have an engineer in those days, in addition to the third-class radio licenses that every disc jockey had to have, there was an engineer with a first-class license to do maintenance work on the transmitter. And radio transmitters are pretty fussy things sometimes. It could go out of whack pretty easy, so you had to keep an eye on it. And excuse me, you had to keep an eye on it. As the morning man, I was responsible for the station that I first started at, WJCM it was called, was what they call a daytimer station, which meant that it came on at 6 o'clock in the morning and went off at sundown, which was at different times of the year. It was a different time. So in the summertime, we could be on till, say, 8:30. In the wintertime, 5:30. So the length of the day was a problem sometimes. I mean, you just... You know, you'd get your listeners during the day, and then, you know, you'd go off the air, and maybe they wouldn't come back the next day. You know, they'd switch over to another station then. Eventually, the station made the investment of becoming a full-time station. Now, this had its limitations because... and the reason for the engineers at a radio station is your signal travels in a certain direction. The way it's set up, you can customize the antennas to send your signal out in a certain direction. Ours was pretty. Our daytime signal was pretty much a straightforward thing. It didn't have too many directional things, but. To go on at night, we had to change that because signals go farther at night, and there were other radio stations with the same call numbers. We were 960, and there was another radio station in Tennessee. We were a 5,000-watt station, and they were a 50,000-watt station. So... their signal would interfere with ours, and sometimes on a good day we were capable of messing with their signal. So we had to be really careful about that. But So we were playing The Music of Your Life, and this the editor of the paper that I mentioned was in the community theater that I belonged to. When I first got to the station, the manager wanted to get more involved with community activities. So we joined the Junior Chamber of Commerce and Elks Club and that sort of thing. And one of the groups that he wanted us to get involved with was the local community theater. Now, they had just come into existence about a year or so before that. So it was a pretty small-time operation. They didn't really have a theater. They would use the high school theaters or the civic centers, whatever was available to put the plays on. And so he and I went down. They were putting on a play called Harvey, which is about the Invisible Rabbit. Jimmy Stewart did a marvelous job in that movie, and he also did it on Broadway as a stage play. Anyway, so they were doing Harvey. There were 8 parts available to fill in the play. There were 8 people that showed up for the audition. So everybody that was there got a part. So the manager and I got our parts. He wasn't too interested in becoming an actor or anything, but he just took a little small part. It was small but showy, you know, one of those things you could make a lot out of if you were an actor that was inclined to do that. And I had never thought about being an actor either. But yeah, I got with this group, and it was they seemed to be a pretty friendly group, and they were welcoming, and I wanted to be a part of the community too. So I took the part, and it was a fairly good part. So I did that, and we put the play on, and they only did this for about they would only put on about. Maybe 6 performances on the weekends. So it was not, it wouldn't take over your life, in other words, you know, so you could put some time into it and still do other things. So I did the play, got friendly with the editor of the paper, who was a big part of the founding group for the theater, and that was I became a big fish in a really small pond. You know, I was well known, and you know, if you want to say famous for that kind of community, people knew me and. You know, and I knew them. It was a small town, so you could know a lot of people. She took a liking to me, and she liked to report on things that I did on the radio, and that sort of thing. I became a writer for the paper. I would do publicity. I would do publicity for the theater group, and I turned out to be a pretty good writer. And I didn't know that I could do that either. So, as I said when I started off here, I was 37 years old and didn't know what I was going to do for the rest of my life until I accidentally got involved with radio and the theater, and then I knew. So I had something that I liked, that I was good at. Pretty good at it anyway, and met a lot of interesting people. Met my ex-wife there, my plans of starting off in Sebring and then moving up to a bigger market and then a bigger market and then on to New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and that sort of thing took a back seat. I became so comfortable in that town. I'd always lived in big cities, Detroit and Chicago and Miami. And a little town like that where everybody knew what you were doing, you know, you really had no secrets. But it was comfortable. I felt like I belonged there. So I stayed there 20 years. To make a long story even longer, 20 years. And the theater group grew in popularity. It was a lot of talented people in this small town. When we put on a play, there were people that could perform it well. It wasn't just a bunch of bumblers up there. I got some good parts and some good plays, and I like that. I like doing that sort of thing. Like I say, 20 years. The theater itself, the city of Sebring, gave us a building that had been a civic center, but it was like a World War II building. So it was on its last legs, and they didn't know what to do with it. Should they tear it down or whatever? So the theater people went in there and said, we'd like to use this. And so the city gave us a 100-year lease on it for a dollar a year or something, you know, to make something out of it. And over the years, that building, which was just a big empty room, really, turned into a professional stage. The community was very supportive. We had we had sponsors that invested a lot of money into that operation. And eventually, a stage was built that was the equal of most stages that you would see in bigger cities, with the sort of equipment for moving sets and facilities for the actors, and a place to build sets and that sort of thing. And it was a dinner theater too, so it was very popular for people to come to that. And they did. It was every single one of our shows was sold out. We would do shows on the weekend for 3 or 4 weekends, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Every single show sold out. That's how popular it was in that community, and it was really appreciated. It was nice to belong to a group like that. That had such an influence on the culture, you know, for what it was in that little town. But it did. I made a lot of friends there, and after 20 years, I thought. I had a chance to come to Orlando and work at one of the dinner theaters here, and get paid for it. The theater in Sebring was all amateurs. Nobody got paid, so I thought getting paid for performing would be a good thing. So I went to work at this place. It was a medieval times, which a lot of people around the country know that. There's 10 of them now. 10 castles. And the next thing I knew, I had been there for 23 years, and that's where I am now, and that's where I think I'm going to continue to be until they throw me out. Well, that's my story, and I'm running out of breath, so thank you for listening, and have a wonderful life.
Thank you so much, David. I learned many things about you that I didn't know, and this was terrific. People will enjoy this. Thank you. Are you sure you're finished recording? That was